Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk. Seems like hardly a day goes by that we don't hear about another arrest of an American extremist planning a mass shooting or assassination of an election official or judge or foreign terrorists planning some mass casualty event here. Then there's the rising tide of Chinese espionage and hacking cases and reports of Russian disinformation efforts to sow chaos in our elections, all of which has put a heavy burden on the FBI, our primary domestic counterintelligence and counterterrorism agency, to thwart such plots without infringing on the First Amendment rights of Americans to speak their minds, no matter how extreme their views. The FBI hardly has a spotless record in this regard. To discuss this threat matrix, my guest today is Frank Figliuzzi, who spent much of his three-plus decades in the FBI running major field offices before retiring in 2012 as Assistant Director of the FBI's Counterintelligence Division. You've probably seen Frank on NBC or MSNBC, where he's a regular contributor. He's also been out and about this week talking about his new book, Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. Frank Figliuzzi, welcome back to Spy Talk. It's great to have you. You have a very busy schedule with the new book out, and plus all the news about the FBI and domestic and terrorism and so on. So let's start there. What a busy week for the FBI. We've got ISIS-linked terrorists arrested in several cities. We've got a surge in domestic terrorism, which Director Wray testified about. We've got the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing groups advocating that the FBI be brought out from underneath the Justice Department and put in charge of the president, or the president put in charge of it if Trump is reelected. So a lot to discuss. Let's first talk about this foreign terrorist threat. Director Wray testified that there's been a huge upsurge in foreign-linked domestic threats here since the October 7th attack. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You know, I've been carefully watching, as you have, Jeff, the language that continues to come out of Chris Wray in terms of its increasing boldness and confidence and strength. And having served 25 years in the FBI and some of it at the Hoover Building in Washington, I know that words are carefully chosen, and that when I hear Chris Wray repeatedly say publicly, mostly on the Hill, that he's fearful of a coordinated international terror attack post October 7, particularly, we got to pay attention to that. That stuff gets approved not only by the Attorney General, but the National Security Council. The DNI has to approve that those kind of statements. And ultimately, the president has to be on board. So when we hear the director say this, it's not just fear-mongering. It's not just, oh, I'd like some more money in my budget, please. I think I'll just scare people. This has to be approved at such multiple high levels that the data has to be there to back up the statement. And it's there.
Well, you know, those of us who are a bit long in the tooth do question whether this is fear-mongering. It's been known to happen before. Everyone wants more money, whether it's the Agriculture Department or EPA or whoever. And the FBI is in a particular position to say, we really know what's going on here, and we have these threats, and you really need to give us more money. I must say that actually, beside the terrorism quotient here, the challenge of Chinese espionage, which was more applicable, it seems to me, for the need for more money of the FBI, for the FBI to deal with the Chinese. What's your experience on that?
I'm glad you're raising other threats. As Director Rick did in his most recent statements on the Hill, because he pointed out that the FBI budget right now has come in at $500 million less than they say they need to do the mission. That's staggering. I mean, you know, when I came into the FBI, I don't know if we had a budget of $500 million. Now they're saying they're $500 million down in terms of what they need. And he points to, as you just said, often he's pointing to the China cyber threat and the China threat writ large. He actually, you know, has begun citing the number of Chinese cases open in the FBI, which I'm a little concerned about. I'm not sure that we need to tell the adversary how many cases we have, but it's David and Goliath with regard to the threat posed by China. And it's on so many levels. But yes, they have literally battalions of people that get out of bed every day trying to steal what we have. And much of that happens in the cyber realm, the theft of trade secrets, intellectual property. If people think, well, it doesn't impact me, it's just about stealing military secrets, it is not. They literally will steal anything that's not nailed down. They're beginning to get into supply chain issues, routers. It is a daunting task, and the numbers are grossly disproportionate in terms of the numbers that the Bureau has to counter that threat, if they can ever actually counter that threat.
And do you think Congress, at least the House side, which is very suspicious of the FBI, are they going to give them this money?
I don't think the FBI is going to get everything it wants. And I'm not implying, by the way, Jeff, that it should get everything it wants. There is a negotiation game that goes on with regard to negotiating on a budget. But you don't negotiate national security threats. And I think where the Bureau can prove they've got the data and the threats are there, they need to get the money to address the threat. And one worry I have that's kind of on a larger kind of 30,000-foot level, Jeff, is we can rattle off all the threats right now, from domestic terrorism to international terrorism, counterintelligence, China writ large, let's not forget the massive amount of fraud and white-collar crime, violent crime, gangs, organized crime, healthcare fraud, public corruption.
Drugs.
How can we not? You know, he cited drugs on the Hill. A fentanyl crisis, of course. So my concern is, from what I know, from sources, from interactions with the Bureau, I am concerned they are stretched way too thin right now, Jeff. I think they're playing whack-a-mole with the threats.
Do you think that this is getting across to most Americans? I mean, we have a candidate on the Republican side and his allies who are constantly attacking the FBI, much in a way that the FBI was attacked from the left back in the 60s and 70s as being an unchecked domestic police force. Do you get the sense that the tens of millions of Americans who are leaning in that direction agree with former President Trump and other Republican leaders that the FBI is not to be trusted? What do you sense? Do you have conversations outside of our little bubble that tell you where this is going one way or another?
It's not good. The erosion of credibility and trust by the Trump administration and his minions, and this, of course, continues because they view the FBI correctly as the investigative agency that's doing its job right now and investigating all of these folks. And let's include over 1,000 arrests with regard to January 6th participants, who, by the way, they couldn't care less about in terms of, you know, the Trump people. They're pretending that they love these people. Yeah, I think he's done some real harm to our institutions, FBI in particular. I think there is distrust, and that's a death knell for an institution that depends on public cooperation. When those agents flash their credentials at someone's door, they've got to have that individual go, okay, I'll help. I don't know today, and it's not good. They claim the recruiting is up. They have no problem recruiting, amen, for young people who say, sign me up for that misery. I want to serve the nation. But it's bigger than the FBI. People don't trust the Centers for Disease Control. They don't trust the Pentagon. They don't trust the DNI, the DOJ. Nobody loves Garland. You know, the left says he's not doing enough, fast enough. The right says he's evil and he's the deep state. And, you know, our institutions embody our values. And I know that, you know, the drain the swamp advocates think that career people are the deep state, but it's that rank and file career government crowd that actually carries out the business of government and carries on the values that got us here. Three equal branches of government, preserving and protecting the Constitution, the rule of law. If you don't like that, then you're talking about an entirely different America than we've been living in.
I wonder if these continuing arrests of people on January 6th are having a boomerang effect and is fueling this distrust of the government. The FBI's website, for example, says in the 40 months since January 6th, more than 1,424 individuals have been charged in nearly all 50 states for crimes related to the January 6th breach of the Capitol, including more than 500 individuals charged with assaulting or impeding law enforcement, a felony. The investigation remains ongoing. I think there is almost sort of a rough parallel here for the much ballyhooed high-level prosecution of Hunter Biden for a crime that's repeated day after day in America and hardly gets any attention. You know, it just seems to me that the Bureau is in a no-win position at this point.
It's consuming every single field office, with the possible exception of Honolulu, the January 6th cases. I will tell you right now, it's requiring virtually all hands on deck. Do I like that idea? No. I mean, we just talked about how I'm concerned that they're stretched too thin. And now you've got people who would be otherwise working white collar, healthcare fraud, drugs. And now, you know, hey, come on, we're going to arrest this guy. It's a tactical arrest. You know, he broke something inside the Capitol. I'm concerned about it. I'm concerned about it. Don't get me wrong. I'm all about accountability and consequences for sure. And even the prosecutors are having to be appointed special AUSAs. You know, this is all happening in D.C., but we've got federal prosecutors who are never physically meeting their client. The target that they're prosecuting. You know, they're calling in on a Zoom call from Puerto Rico or Oregon, and they're, you know, I'm your prosecutor. I'm your public defender from Alabama. You know, and it's stretching the system to the max. And now we have a legal challenge, which I'm tracking, on some of the charges, which could get tossed, which involves being charged with interfering with an act of Congress or interfering with an official government act. And some courts are saying, I don't think that applies here. This is going to go all the way up.
Yeah, I think, again, the logs are piling up on the fire for a Trump administration, should it take office next January, to move the FBI back into the direct control of the president, which sets my hair up straight.
Yeah.
because obviously the FBI and the Justice Department figure are sensitive to the proclivities of the White House and what it expects and it wants, the initiatives that it launches for, let's say, to concentrate on drugs, yeah, concentrate on organized crime. The White House had to prod J. Edgar Hoover into investigating organized crime. So, you know, the White House does have a lot of influence over the FBI, even though it's independent, you know, independent by statute. So at the same time, we have a rising threat from some of these same quarters that were deeply involved in January 6th, like the Proud Boys, who are mobilizing to carry out violence. You know, one can infer that they're mobilizing to carry out violence around the next election, which surely Trump will denounce should he be lose the voter count. There was a long piece by my friend Aaron Rostin in Reuters about the Proud Boys and saying they are really gearing up. He wrote that the Proud Boys are back 4 years after the failed effort to overturn Trump's 2020 electoral defeat. The violent all-male extremist group that led the storming of the Congress is rebuilding and regaining strength. So does the FBI have a predicate to go after the Proud Boys because of what they say?
No. So here's the deal. In addition to what you just cited, there are additional clear indications that something's being planned already. What am I talking about? An outfit called the Tech Transparency Project that does good work. They live and breathe analyzing private chat rooms of violent extremist groups. They put out a report a couple of weeks ago that said they have the current activity back on Facebook of previously banned violent groups, militia groups in particular we're talking about, is now at a number not seen since January 6th. And they are recruiting members. And this is not, you know, we're not talking about the guys, the good old boys who want to go out in the woods and shoot at beer cans and drink beer on weekends. These are groups that were previously banned, have had their members arrested for participating in January 6th. They're three percenter type groups, many of them. And they've decided Facebook is the place for them. It's the safe haven because Facebook has done away with their content moderators, hundreds, if not thousands of content moderators. Mm-hmm. They seem to have thrown up their hands, you know, twice, you know, once burned, twice shy. They don't want a part in the Olympic, in the campaign in any way. So they're not going to watch anything. And they claim that they're knocking off people when they see them. But we're into the thousands and thousands of members being recruited on Facebook, particularly in the groups section of Facebook, where, you know, the goal here is to increase engagement. Facebook is all about profit. That means increased engagement and clicks. You get that in groups. The algorithm starts suggesting to you, hey, you might want to talk to this guy because, you know, he's talking about the same stuff you're talking about. And this is going on virtually unchecked on Facebook right now. So I'm concerned, and I don't want to hear law enforcement say, as they did on January 6th, yeah, we didn't know anything about it. We didn't watch it. You're asking, you know, is there a mandate? Is there a legal ability for the Bureau to monitor all these groups and figure out who's aspirational, who's going to execute on what they're saying? No, not really. The predication has to be violence. And it has, you know, so yes, if there's a group that has a propensity toward violence, that violence will get you predication. But your question was because of what they say.
Mm-hmm.
No.
What they say on Facebook or anyplace else.
If it's planning violence, you know, I can't wait to kill Pence. I you know.
Well, how do you, excuse me, Frank, how do you know that they're planning violence unless you infiltrate them or are electronically monitoring them?
Yeah, this is the chicken or the egg. And you're not allowed to. You can certainly do public. You're allowed to monitor publicly accessible, no expectation of privacy chatter. Sure. Does the FBI?
Right. Let's go back over that. Yeah. So the FBI is authorized to watch Facebook for these groups and threats of violence.
If it's open source, but if you get into a group, so first of all, number one, the logistics challenge of that is immense, right? There's not tens of thousands of analysts sitting in front of screens at the FBI, you know, looking at, you know, they're not watching our Facebook page. You know, they're not, you know, they've got to have some reason to narrow down this universe of people that they want to pay attention to. And that has to be known violent extremism. And then once you get into the group chat, right, because they're going to quickly take you. The way it's working on Facebook with these militia groups is they recruit you in the groups function. They like the mainstream feel of Facebook. It legitimizes them. But very quickly, once they vet you, they're going to move you to Telegram or some other place in a private chat room.
And can the FBI monitor those chat rooms as well?
They can try really hard to develop sources, informants that are already vetted by these groups and get in. They can put undercover personnel in that chat room if they can pass the vetting process. And they have to get it right. They, you know, look at the kid who was the El Paso Walmart shooter, who had, you know, hook, line, and sinker brought into the brown invaders language that Trump and others were using. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only when somebody in the group says, I think this kid's going to hurt somebody, and goes to law enforcement, and that is too late because he's literally driving to El Paso, Texas. Yeah, it's a problem. It is whack-a-mole. You've got to be in the right place at the right time.
So let me prompt you to x-ray this some more. So how it works. So the FBI is loosely monitoring, has people watching Facebook and Telegram and so on.
With credit. Well, so open sourced in a way that makes sense, right? They're not looking at the knitting group in your hometown. They're, you know, it's got to make sense to use precious resources to monitor some open source activity.
Okay. So what do you guess that the FBI is doing in regard to social media and these militant groups organizing on social media?
Okay. So for those that would be properly predicated because of a history of violence, let's, for example, say those who have already been charged in January 6th.
So let's say the Proud Boys who have a history of violence. So the FBI would feel it's authorized, or would they need a warrant to begin monitoring that group?
The answer is it depends. Again, there's no expectation of privacy in an open source conversation, but I can assure you the Proud Boys are not stupid enough to have a dirty conversation in the open. So they're going to go into a chat room. Then you've got to establish that. Remember, the U.S. does not have a mechanism in place to designate domestic terror groups. I keep hearing people, even smart people, you know, on TV, analysts, commentators, oh, well, the Proud Boys are a domestic terror group. Who told you that? Because no, there's no such thing. We don't designate domestic groups as terror organizations. And by the way, when people are outraged by that, I point out to them, well, I'd like you to know that during the Trump administration, Trump tweeted one day that he, you know, I hereby declare Antifa a terrorist organization. Well, that's very nice, but we don't have a mechanism to do that. And if you have a president that's going to get on Twitter and go, I hereby declare the Democratic Party a domestic terror organization, we're going to have a problem. So be careful what you ask for. I say that because it gets into the legal dilemma facing the FBI, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. We don't designate domestic terror groups. So if I'm a new Proud Boys member, but my leader, Enrique Terrio, who's in prison, was convicted of seditious conspiracy, do you have predication to open on me? I just joined Proud Boys 2 weeks ago. You going to open a case on me? Or is somebody in that chat room predicated? That will do it for you.
So in a real life scenario, let's say some of those people at FBI who are monitoring social media for threats goes to a supervisor and says, you know, I think we ought to really try to recruit someone in this group. So how does that work? Does someone just make a telephone call to one of these members, or reach out via email or something and say, we'd like to talk to you?
Well, very often I hate to do it the hard way, but that sometimes that's all you have left is you jam somebody up in that group. You know, hey, we're going to have your probation violated, or your parole violated. And it could be somebody who was charged in January 6th.
Or someone who is not on parole.
Yeah.
You go knock on their door. I know this has been a practice from the FBI for a long time. When it senses that someone might be joining a threat to carry out violence, it just goes knock on the door and say, hey, we just want to let you know that we're around and maybe you shouldn't be doing this. In other words, no warrant, no opening of an investigation, just a friendly visit to someone to say, you know, cut the crap.
Yeah, those are called knock and talks. And knock and talks are viewed as kind of not so much source development, but rather last resort. Why do I say last resort? Because now you're essentially tipping your hand. Hey, we know what's going on. We know you're involved. If it gets any worse, someone's getting arrested. Well, you better be prepared to lose the insights you already have into that chat room, into that group, because, you know, he could run back and say, hey, they're onto us. Let's go deeper. Let's get darker. Right. And now you lose that. That's a problem. The other thing, you know, what we're really talking about and kind of talking around is the absolutely necessary relationship between the social media platforms and law enforcement. Absolutely crucial. And, you know, when I think Facebook is throwing up their hands, I think part of it is the beating that everybody took, you know, at Twitter and Facebook and Google with regard to Twittergate, right? Oh my God, the FBI visited Twitter and told them they think that there's Russian propaganda and disinformation and that the Hunter Biden laptop thing is being used as, you know, in an attempt to beat up Biden. Be careful. Some of the ads you're posting and propaganda are coming straight from the Russian intelligence services. Okay, I look at that and go, yeah, that's every day. Yeah, we did that. Yep, we do that every day. Yeah, got the Facebook security people on speed dial. Congress flips out, right? Flips out. FBI must have dictated that they take down things. Even Elon Musk said, no. No, I looked into this. They actually didn't tell us to take anything. Oh, but that kind of relationship has got, because the platforms are the first ones that are going to see. They've got the algorithms. They've got them. And they're going to, just like they've got them for child sexual trafficking, they've got them for violence. And they do have to pick up the phone and call law enforcement. And they do, but Congress hates it. At least the far right hates it.
Yeah, that's, you know, the whole subject of election interference, fake videos and so on is maybe a subject for another day. It's something that Director Wray brought up, sort of slapping his forehead in effect and saying we're really facing almost an overwhelming tide of election interference efforts from all over the place, not just foreign, but domestic. And of course, the Russians don't really need to do as much as they used to, because it's managed to capture groups in the U.S. to pick up its propaganda and circulate it. Another issue very quickly I want to touch on is this Michigan Wolverine Watchman case, which has gotten a lot of attention over the years. This was the group tried to kidnap. They plotted to kidnap the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, in 2020. The prosecution has been troublesome. An appeals court is entertaining the notion from the defense that the FBI instigated the plot itself. You know, it's one thing to infiltrate a group for a while and get away with it. It's been done, going back to the Klan, you know, some 50 plus years ago. And it's very difficult to keep an informant in a group that's being very secretive and not urge the informant to say, well, bring up the idea of an attack and see how they bite on it, right? I mean, this is tricky stuff.
It is tricky. It's a legal conundrum, and you can get trapped at every turn. We certainly don't want to see entrapment occur with people who are not predisposed to commit the crime. That's the key here. Entrapment involves somebody who shows no prior indication of any interest in committing the crime, and you lead them to that crime. The undercover technique is essential in some of these cases. Trusting informants is really tough. And there were informants in this case, but I will say this openly, the conduct of at least one, personally and professionally, and when I'm talking about his conduct, at least one FBI agent in this was horrific. I'm not even sure he's still an FBI agent. I don't know. But that doesn't help matters when agents are conducting themselves unprofessionally. What I keep telling people in this case is there were convictions. Ultimately, there were acquittals and there were convictions. And that's the way that's the way it goes. But we have a governor who's still alive. And if people don't like that, then they've got a problem. Not the FBI.
Yeah, it's very tricky. And as you say, there are so many threats appearing on the horizon, from domestic militant groups to foreign terrorists to influence election interference and influence peddling and so on, that it must be daunting for the FBI to figure out what its priorities are and not be able to clamp down on all of them. So I think.
Yeah, just real quick, let's throw one other thing on the table that has them stretched thin in terms of threats that never existed when I was in the Bureau, which is they now have a unit at headquarters that's dedicated entirely to working threats against FBI agents and FBI employees. And, you know, my God, and I listen. There are people designated in every one of the FBI 56 field offices to work threat remediation. My God, really? That's where we are right now, is employees fearful that they're going to get shot walking out the building for lunch.
Because of people riled up that the FBI is a criminal organization. And has to be stopped. So, wow, that's really something. I hadn't heard of that. Do you have any figures on how many threats were leveled at FBI agents over the past period of time, or the dynamic?
I don't have all the numbers, but it's so bad that Merrick Garland wrote a letter to the editor in the Washington Post this week. Check it out. And he said, enough is enough with the threats against agents in the FBI. I've had it. We're not going to be intimidated. And he pointed out arrests that I hadn't even heard of. There's arrests happening every single week. There was one in California that he cited in his op-ed to kill an FBI agent. This is happening, I'm told, weekly. Are we seeing the media coverage of it? Not really. Should it be played up on TV? Maybe not. Maybe other people will be incited to try it.
Yeah, that's always a challenge for the media in writing up all these threats or, you know, incitement, the rhetoric and so on, because it calls more attention to it when you write it up and denounce it. So that's a big problem. Finally, Frank, we're running out of time, but before we go, got to mention your new book. And speaking of going undercover in sort of a way, you went out and rode with truckers for your new book about kidnappings and sex trafficking in the trucking industry. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, sure. Real quick. Thanks for mentioning it. I want to get the message out, because it's not, for me, it's not about selling the books as much as it is getting the word out that we've got a problem in the United States. It involves sex traffic victims. It involves 850 murders alongside our nation's highways, almost all of women, almost all of sex trafficked women. There are 200 of those cases that are considered active and unsolved right now. And the FBI is looking at 450 suspects in those 200 unsolved cases. So when I kind of prided myself in the FBI, having been a chief inspector, assistant director, of knowing all the nooks and crannies in the FBI. Only after retirement did I get word that this initiative was still going, that it involved the numbers I just described to you. And I said, okay, wait a minute. After the FBI said, we can't tell you much more than this, because they really aren't the FBI's cases. They're state and local murder cases. I decided to put on my investigator hat, hit the road, and do 2,000 miles in a big rig.
I sympathize with you wanting to get out of your suit and get out on the hustings and get back to basic investigating.
It's not the Ritz-Carlton in the back of that rig. Let me tell you something. I slept in the top bunk in the sleeper berth, and 2,000 miles was enough for me.
I'm looking forward to reading it myself. Anyway, it's called Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers by Frank Figliuzzi. Frank, great having you back on the podcast. Thanks so much. Appreciate your valuable time. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.